All right, so this is Bio 241, and it is March 5th, Thursday. We're going to start a new chapter today, that's autonomic nervous system. We're not going to cover anything in central nervous system on the test after next time. And don't forget, there is a test next time, right? So there's going to be a test Tuesday. And what is that going to cover? Let's see if I can remember. It's going to be enzymes, it's going to be cellular respiration, and it's going to be neurophysiology. So I guess it's just those three chapters. Only three chapters. Okay. All right. So this won't be on the test. A lot of this chapter is review. What you do have to pay attention to in this chapter are the different kinds of receptors for the different parts of the autonomic nervous system. That's probably the most important thing. But we'll do a little review of many things. All right, but before I get started, any questions? Anybody have any questions? Did I answer your question? I forgot.
Okay.
Yeah, I posted that yesterday sometime. Okay. All right, so introduction. Autonomic nervous system manages our physiology in ways that we don't consciously have to control. So what do we have conscious control over in our bodies?
Skeletal muscle.
What else? I'm sorry? Nobody else has a suggestion. As a matter of fact, that's it. That is the only thing you have conscious control over. So that means that everything else is controlled by the autonomic nervous system. So that's how important the autonomic nervous system is, because it controls almost everything in your body except for skeletal muscle. Okay, so the autonomic nervous system regulates organs, organ systems, smooth muscle, glands, and cardiac tissue. So if you think of the autonomic nervous system, a nice simplified way of thinking of that is that it innervates glands, smooth muscle, and cardiac muscle. All right, those are the other effector organs besides skeletal muscle. Smooth muscle maintains a resting tone in the absence of nerve stimulation so that it can contract by itself, unlike skeletal muscle. It has properties of contraction all by itself. And as a matter of fact, when we take the nerve supply away from smooth muscle, it actually gets more irritable, more sensitive. It might contract more. We call that denervation hypersensitivity. And indeed, some types of smooth muscle is spontaneously active. That means that it will even contract on its own. And that is definitely true of cardiac tissue as well. If we remove all innervation away from the heart, guess what it's going to do? It's going to continue to beat on its own. And what the autonomic nervous system does is that it regulates the frequency of or the rate of contraction of these muscles. So it can adjust the activity. So autonomic nervous system input simply increases or decreases the intrinsic activity inherent in these different kinds of muscles. Okay, so let's compare an autonomic pathway with a typical somatic pathway. So when I say somatic, what does that mean? What's another name for somatic? Another name for it would be voluntary, a voluntary pathway. And what does a voluntary nerve innervate? Yeah, skeletal muscle. So it's a skeletal motor pathway or a skeletal efferent pathway. Somatic just means to skeletal muscle. So here we can see the nerve cell body in the ventral gray matter of the spinal cord. And so this is a multipolar neuron. It leaves, what is this structure right here? Aha, you thought you could forget your anatomy, but you can never forget your anatomy, I'm sorry to say. Okay. This is what? The ventral root. And the ventral root, of course, is 100% motor. It joins the spinal nerve right here, and that spinal nerve then takes the nerve axon to the effector organ, and since this is a somatic motor pathway, the effector organ is skeletal muscle. That's what you have control over. So how many neurons does it take to take a signal from the central nervous system all the way to the effector organ in a somatic motor pathway? Yeah, you just see one, right? There's just one multipolar neuron. And that's different compared to an autonomic system. An autonomic system, you see the cell body in the lateral horn of the gray matter of the spinal cord. It leaves the ventral root because that's the motor root, of course, and enters the spinal nerve. Okay, and it doesn't follow the ramus to the effector organ, but that sympathetic and so this is in particular sympathetic outflow, it leaves the spinal nerve and enters the sympathetic chain ganglia. And the sympathetic chain ganglia are almost like auxiliary spinal cords on either side, the right and left side of the spinal cord, for sympathetic activity in particular. And in this particular case, this neuron synapses with a second neuron, which then leaves the sympathetic chain and goes to an effector organ, which in this particular case is going to be some smooth muscle of the digestive tract. So the first thing is, how many neurons do you see does it take to get sympathetic activity from the central nervous system to the effector organ? And is it different than a somatic motor pathway? Yeah, it's one for somatic and two for an autonomic pathway, right? And that is true with just one exception to that rule that we're going to look at. All right, so since we have two neurons with a ganglion in between, remember a ganglion is a group of nerve cell bodies and dendrites in the peripheral nervous system someplace. Do you see a ganglion in another location on this slide anywhere? Do you see another ganglia someplace? Yeah, you see the dorsal root ganglia right here in the dorsal root. And so this is just what, a unipolar neuron? Unipolar neurons are what kind of function? They are sensory neurons. And so this is the afferent pathway into the central nervous system, right? So this is the dorsal root that is 100% afferent, and that's the dorsal root ganglia. The sympathetic chain ganglia are for sympathetic outflow, for sympathetic motor activity. All right, so this first neuron right here is what we call the preganglionic neuron. And the one that's after the ganglion, here's the cell body, and that's why we call this a ganglion right here. This is the postganglionic neuron, right? The preganglionic, postganglionic neuron. So we're going to look at a synapse right here. This is the presynaptic neuron. This is a postsynaptic. But for autonomic outflow, we usually talk about it as what? Preganglionic versus a postganglionic cell. All right, and this diagram I like because you probably remember from anatomy what these nerves right here, these pathways are called. All right, and can you remember from anatomy what the state of myelination is with the preganglionic fiber compared to the postganglionic fiber? Are they the same? Is one myelinated and one not myelinated, or what can you remember from that? Okay, the preganglionic fiber is myelinated, and the postganglionic fiber is non-myelinated. So it'd be really nice if this is a gray color right here, but it kind of looks blue or something to me, so it doesn't really look gray. All right, but this one should look maybe white because this is the preganglionic fiber that is myelinated. So this right here, since it carries myelinated fibers, this is what we call what, the white ramus communicantes, right? And this one over here is a way for sympathetic nerves to leave the sympathetic chain, and the ones that leave are the postganglionic neurons, and they are not myelinated, so this is the gray ramus communicantes, right? So that's just a little refresher for you. Okay, so somatic motor pathway, one neuron, autonomic pathway, two neurons, separated by what? The ganglion right here. Yeah. Yeah, yeah, these are both motor neurons. Okay. All right, divisions of the autonomic nervous system. You could probably lecture me on this particular topic, but what are some divisions of the autonomic nervous system? What might be some ways you could think about it?
Sympathetic.
Yeah, sympathetic and the parasympathetic nervous system. They usually have opposite effects in the body, so they are antagonistic to each other. And is that a good thing or a bad thing? Yeah, it's really a good thing, because in your automobile, give me the name of two mechanisms that you have to have. You wouldn't even dream of driving your automobile without these two antagonistic mechanisms. Yeah, the gas pedal and the brake pedal, right? So that's how your body is controlled by the autonomic nervous system, using the parasympathetic and sympathetic. If one nervous system is excitatory, the other is going to be inhibitory. You don't always know if the sympathetic nervous system is going to be inhibitory or excitatory. The only thing you know is if you know one, the other one is going to be opposite to it, right? So that's usually how the autonomic nervous system works. All right, so we have the sympathetic and parasympathetic divisions. They usually have antagonistic effects. which is perfect to maintain precise control and balance in our bodies. And so that's what maintains homeostasis. All right, the sympathetic nervous system mediates what we call the fight or flight reaction. The parasympathetic mediates the rest and digest reaction. So when you are under stress, all right, then your body is governed by the sympathetic nervous system. And when you're in a fed state, in a restful state, then the parasympathetic nervous system is controlling your body, or is mostly influencing your body. All right, so for instance, if you go see a movie, okay, and you're going to pay, how much does it cost to go see a movie now? Like $50 or something? If you have to pay for parking and all that kind of stuff, all right? So if you're going to pay that kind of money, what nervous system do you want to go have stimulated? Okay, parasympathetic or sympathetic nervous system?
Sympathetic.
Okay, I hear both. Raise your hand for parasympathetic nervous system. All right, and raise your hand for sympathetic nervous system. Just a couple, okay? Well, you're going to pay that $50 and see a movie. If it's the parasympathetic nervous system, you're going to fall asleep during that movie, okay? There's no way you're going to pay $50 to go someplace and just fall asleep. You want to be, what, excited, stimulated. You want your heart rate to increase, right? You want your pupils to dilate. You want your respiratory rate to do what? To increase, right? And did I say perspiration? That's going to increase, right? You want all those effects because that's what's going to keep you awake during the movie, and when you walk out, you'll say, wow, that was an amazing movie because it elicited all those visceral responses in you. All right, so that's what we're going to learn about how the sympathetic nervous system operates. But if you go see a movie that just stimulates your parasympathetic nervous system, all right, your pupils are going to constrict, you're going to fall asleep, and somebody will have to wake you up after the movie, right? It's not worth the $50. So sympathetic nervous system is the one we want stimulated, typically. So what does that do, and where do these signals come from? Well, remember, the sympathetic division has thoracolumbar outflow. That means that sympathetic nerves leave the central nervous system only from T1 to L2. That's the only way that sympathetic activity can leave. All right, so when I say T1, what does that mean to you? That's thoracic one, right, all the way down to T12 and then L1 and L2. That's the only way sympathetic nerves can leave the central nervous system. And then they move in, so here we have probably I guess that could be a rib right there, so this would be a thoracic region right here. So there are sympathetic nerves that leave and then enter the sympathetic chain via the white ramus communicantes. And once in the sympathetic chain, these nerves can maybe pass through via a splanchnic nerve. It can go up a division or two through the sympathetic chain, or it can go down a division or two through the sympathetic chain, or it can even synapse right here on the postganglionic fiber in the sympathetic chain ganglion. And then that the postganglionic fiber can take a number of pathways to get to the effector organ, right? But remember, sympathetic division is thoracolumbar. Okay, so the sympathetic chain ganglia is just one of two possible ganglia that the sympathetic nervous system uses. The other ones are what we call the prevertebral ganglia, which will be in front of the vertebral column. And I don't see any on this slide right here. The sympathetic chain sometimes are called the paravertebral because they're on either side of the vertebral column. All right, so the sympathetic nervous system is characterized by divergence and convergence of neurons, which causes sympathetic activity to act as a unit. We call that mass activation. So when there is sympathetic outflow from your sympathetic nervous system, it affects all of your body pretty much at one time because of these pathways of divergence and convergence. So when we look at the spinal cord, all right, so here is a efferent pathway, signals leave, get into the spinal nerve, all right, and this diagram is a little wrong because here is the white ramus communicantes, the nerve actually should enter the sympathetic chain right here, but nonetheless, after it does, we see what? many bifurcations in this neuron. It can arise and it can go down the spinal cord, or it can exit and go into the spinal nerve, or pass through via splanchnic nerve to a collateral ganglion someplace. So one nerve can stimulate what? Many different levels and many different effector organs as a result of that. So that's one reason why we call the sympathetic nervous system that it acts by mass activation. Okay, the other thing that you see is that even after these bifurcations, these nerves can join back together again, all right, before they innervate a effector organ. So if there's ever damage to one of these nerves, these sympathetic signals can find what alternate routes to get to the effector organ and still have control over these effector organs. All right, so sympathetic nervous system is characterized by what? Convergence as well as, so here's convergence as well as divergence of signals. Okay. All right, so in this diagram right here, we see the sympathetic chain, and then we see the also on this slide nicely the prevertebral ganglia. Sometimes these are called collateral ganglion. And a nerve, does anybody remember what a nerve is that interconnects a sympathetic chain ganglia with a collateral ganglia? This one right here. This would be an example of a splanchnic nerve. So a splanchnic nerve always interconnects a sympathetic chain with a ganglia with a collateral ganglia. Okay, so you can see that network, that mesh, which is responsible for mass activation. All right, so let's stop and just think a second again. A typical somatic motor pathway, how many neurons does it take to get from spinal cord to effector organ?
One,
that's right. Okay, and for autonomic outflow, it requires two, and there's going to be a ganglia someplace in between, right? You're going to have a preganglionic fiber and a postganglionic fiber. Well, the sympathetic nervous system is so important for controlling all sympathetic activity in your body for fight or flight responses that there is another system that's used that relies on an endocrine system. And this is kind of interesting because in this particular case, you really only have the prevertebral fiber, and not, I mean the preganglionic fiber, but not a postganglionic fiber. So you only have one. So this is a little modification to that scheme. And that is what happens in the sympathoadrenal system. All right, so let's pay a little bit attention to that. So we're going to talk about the adrenal gland. Can anybody remember where the adrenal gland is? Yeah, it's right here, right above the kidneys. And here you can see sympathetic nerves entering the adrenal gland. And the adrenal gland has a cortex as well as medulla, right, a couple parts to it. And the adrenal medulla is specialized, and it acts like a postganglionic fiber in the sympathetic nervous system. All right, so it's a modified collateral ganglia. When sympathetic impulses reach the adrenal medulla, the adrenal medulla releases norepinephrine. What could you tell me about norepinephrine? It's a neurotransmitter, okay? But the adrenal medulla also releases another compound called epinephrine. These are related to each other. I think they're different by one methyl group someplace on the molecule. All right. And then from the adrenal medulla, they're picked up by the circulatory system. There are capillaries right there in the adrenal medulla. They pick up norepinephrine and epinephrine and distribute them everywhere in your body where the where your circulation goes. Okay, so that's an interesting system because we don't really see a postganglionic fiber. It's the cells of the adrenal medulla then that are acting like the postganglionic fiber, and they're releasing epinephrine and norepinephrine. So in this case, what would you like to call norepinephrine that's being released by the, you don't have to know the name of these, but these are chromaffin cells of the adrenal medulla release norepinephrine, okay, that get picked up by the blood. What kind of signaling molecule, how would we define a signaling molecule when it gets picked up by the circulatory system and delivered? What do we label that kind of signaling molecule? That would be a hormone. Okay. So here is norepinephrine. It gets secreted by a modified neuron, but And what kind of signaling molecule gets released by a neuron? A neurotransmitter. But yet, all right, it doesn't just move across the synapse. It gets picked up by the circulatory system, so it's really acting like a hormone. So what would you like to call it? Would you like to call it a neurotransmitter, or would you like to call it a hormone? And as a matter of fact, exactly right. You have to modify your thinking a little bit and actually call it a more descriptive term, actually, like how it's behaving. It's behaving like what? A neurohormone. So a lot of times in physiology classes, they're set up not to talk about the nervous system or the endocrine system because they fuse together into one system in various locations in our body. So a lot of times we teach it as the neuroendocrine system. Okay, because neurotransmitters sometimes act as hormones, and hormones sometimes act as neurotransmitters, the exact same molecule, just applied in a little bit different way in different parts of the body. All right, and the adrenal gland then is stimulated during mass activation, for instance. And that releases these compounds into the circulatory system where they have a relatively long lifetime compared to neurotransmitter in the synaptic cleft. Yeah. Two neurons. Okay, now this one right here, all right, I don't think I have a really good picture, but your anatomy books have a really good picture of this. This system has a modification to that two neuron scheme in the following way. All right, the preganglionic fiber, the nerve cell body is going to be in the lateral horn of the gray matter of the spinal cord. It's going to leave through some kind of thoracolumbar pathway. And it's going to pass right through the sympathetic chain. So here's the sympathetic chain. So this is still the preganglionic fiber. It's going to pass right through the sympathetic chain. And it's going to go to the adrenal medulla. So one nerve fiber goes all the way to the adrenal medulla, where it releases a neurotransmitter on the chromaffin cells of the adrenal medulla. And those chromaffin cells really are neurons, but they don't go anywhere. All right. When they depolarize, they release norepinephrine and epinephrine directly into the adrenal medulla. All right. So these adrenal medulla cells are the postganglionic fibers, but they're modified so that they don't really conduct electrical impulses anywhere. What do? They just immediately release neurohormones into the circulation. So it's still two cells, the preganglionic cell and the postganglionic cell, but the postganglionic cell doesn't carry electrical impulses anywhere. It just releases epinephrine and norepinephrine into the circulation. Okay. So if you need to review that, maybe go back and look at your anatomy book. There's probably a whole page in your anatomy book showing that. All right, so probably this system here has been activated in you. Have you ever been driving down the freeway or something, and then all of a sudden a big tractor trailer is changing lanes and you go, oh my God, I have no place to go, and for sure you're going to die, right? And somehow you have survived, okay? You didn't get into an accident and you survived. But if you really thought you were going to die, what is your body going through at that time, after that time? A lot of stress, right? You're hyperventilating, right? Your pupils, I'm sure, are completely dilated. What about your heart? Is it beating? Yes, it's like popping out of your chest, right? Okay, and your respiratory rate is increased, your bronchioles, your respiratory tract is completely dilated, right, to improve perfusion of the lungs. And so how long does that last for? Does that go away in 15 seconds? No, it persists for a while, and your skeletal muscles are what? They're shaking, right? And that's a result of mass activation, including the adrenal gland, because that epinephrine and norepinephrine, okay, have been released into the circulatory systems, into the circulatory system, and their duration of action is a lot longer than just a neurotransmitter in the synaptic cleft. Okay, all right. So that's another way to think of that. Okay, so that has a long-lasting effect in your body. And so what system was activated there? The sympathetic or parasympathetic? The sympathetic, exactly right, the fight-or-flight response. All right, so epinephrine is made by methylating norepinephrine. Here is tyrosine, that is what, an essential amino acid? I think we talked about that last time or time before. right, which then gets converted into DOPA, then dopamine, which is another neurotransmitter, and dopamine gets converted into norepinephrine, okay, just by changing this one proton to this hydroxyl group right here, and then norepinephrine is converted by adding a methyl group to this amino group right here. This is epinephrine. So this is the major hormone of the adrenal medulla, and this is secreted by what, those quasi-postganglionic fibers that make up the adrenal medulla gland. Right, and this is what stimulates many sympathetic receptors throughout your body, because that's where your circulatory system goes.
Which one of those is considered adrenaline?
Okay. So epinephrine is what we typically call adrenaline in layman's terms, and norepinephrine is what some people call noradrenaline. But in a scientific community, we usually call it epinephrine and norepinephrine, yeah.
So sympathetic only activate under moments of stress, or it can be activated during, like, if you're out in the sun, and you're relaxing, you're trying to sweat. Isn't that how sympathetic causes
you
to sweat?
Yeah, that's going to be some small response of this, yeah, the sympathetic nervous system.
So it's not always under stress.
It's not always under stress, right. That's sort of interesting. Yeah, so if you're body temperature is changing and you start to sweat, I guess in that particular case, I wouldn't think of mass activation of all sympathetic pathways in your body. Okay, so you might start sweating, but your heart rate probably doesn't increase, for instance. Your pupils aren't dilated, of course, because in the sun they're constricted. Okay.
And the which one was 85%?
Oh, from the adrenal medulla, it's epinephrine. So epinephrine is the major molecule released by the adrenal medulla. Okay. And a minor component here, norepinephrine. All right, so again, that shows the importance of diet, because tyrosine is an essential amino acid. Okay, the parasympathetic division the way that parasympathetic signals leave your central nervous system is through cranial nerves and through sacral spinal nerves. So that outflow we call cranial sacral outflow for the parasympathetic division. So if you were going to tell me about a cranial nerve that carries a lot of parasympathetic activity, what would you tell me? Which one is it? I tell you what, how many are there? How many cranial nerves are there? There's 12. That's good. All right. You've taken that anatomy class. Now, which one is the most important for carrying parasympathetic activity? Which of the cranial nerves? Which one is it? Can anybody remember? It's the vagus. Yeah, number 10. Yeah, vagus number 10. Okay. And the vagus nerve, sort of like that network that we saw for the sympathetic nervous system, kind of wanders around, bifurcates all over in the body, wanders around. It doesn't participate in mass activation quite as much as the sympathetic nervous system, but nonetheless it does branch and go to a lot of different places. It wanders around inside your body, and that's why it was named. So what does vagus sort of sound like in terms of somebody that's wandering around all the time?
Vagus?
Yeah, the vagus really means vagabond, because it's wandering around to all kinds of different effector organs in your body. Okay. All right, but remember, the parasympathetic nervous system is part of the autonomic nervous system, so how many neurons does it take to get from central nervous system to effector organ for the parasympathetic nervous system? It's going to take 2, just like the sympathetic, but the organization is a little bit different. Okay, so I guess I'm going to just skip to this slide right here. Okay, and we'll compare and contrast the sympathetic nervous system. All right, this is just a nice diagram reproduced from one of your anatomy books. All right, so what nervous system of autonomics has thoracolumbar outflow? That's sympathetic outflow. And what is cranial sacral outflow? That's for parasympathetic nervous system, and maybe you have a color-coded key here someplace, but what is it? So the blue is parasympathetic. These reds right here are the sympathetic, right? So that clearly shows that. sympathetics have to go through the sympathetic chain ganglia, right, where they might synapse to the postganglionic fiber. And on this diagram, the dotted lines represent the postganglionic fiber. The solid lines are always the preganglionic fiber. The preganglionics are myelinated. The postganglionics are never myelinated. So here we see a solid colored nerve go all the way through the sympathetic chain, right? So it passes through without synapsing to a postganglionic fiber. So what do we call this segment of nerve going from spinal cord to a secondary ganglion someplace that we call collateral ganglion? This is a splanchnic nerve, and there's a couple of them that have names, but you should know that when it just passes through to a collateral ganglia, that's a splanchnic nerve. But it has to synapse there in this collateral ganglion, and then here's the postganglionic fiber going to the effector organ. So in sympathetic, the preganglionic fibers are relatively short, and the postganglionic fibers are relatively long. In the parasympathetic nervous system, it's a little bit different because the preganglionic fibers now go all the way to the effector organ before they find their ganglion. So the preganglionic fibers are relatively long, and the postganglionic fibers, like I can't even see one here, but I can see one here on the uterus. This is what? Really, really short. So can you see how you can compare and contrast the two different nervous systems? Okay. Including the cranial outflow. All right, so let's trace the nerve that goes to the adrenal medulla. How many nerves does it take to go all the way from the central nervous system to the adrenal medulla? Okay, if it's an autonomic pathway, you usually want to say, well, it's going to take two. Okay, but this is a modified system. All right, so here is the adrenal medulla. And what can you tell me about this nerve right here? Is it a dotted line or is it a solid color? It's solid, so that means this is the preganglionic fiber. It goes all the way through via splanchnic, or it passes through the sympathetic chain, even passes through this ganglion right here as a splanchnic nerve. It goes to the adrenal medulla and synapses on a cell in the adrenal medulla, and the cells of the adrenal medulla act as the postganglionic fiber. And when they depolarize, what do these cells of the adrenal medulla do? They secrete primarily epinephrine, which then gets picked up by the circulatory system and activates, right, your whole system, your whole body in a sympathetic way. Okay. So that's a nice comparison, compare and contrast. Yeah.
When you talk about fibers, they're different to the nerve.
That's right. As opposed to like a muscle fiber. So sometimes in anatomy and physiology, when we say fiber, it's just a long and narrow thing. Something that's really long and narrow. All right, so there are proteins that are fibers, like collagen fibers, but cells can actually be fibers if they're long and narrow. For instance, like skeletal muscle cells are called fibers as well. Okay, yeah. The splanchnic nerve is always going to be a preganglionic fiber. So here's a splanchnic, here's a splanchnic, and those are preganglionic fibers because a splanchnic nerve is going to go to a collateral ganglion someplace. And so there's a cell body in that ganglion, because that's how we name it, a ganglion. And coming out of the ganglion is the postganglionic fiber. All right, so here is another splanchnic nerve, right here. Okay. Okay, so here's a table that compares or lists out what the different functions of the two divisions of the autonomic nervous system are. And in a lot of cases, we're going to see that they are antagonistic to each other. All right, so for instance, in the eye, well, it turns out, the sympathetic is stimulatory or excitatory, and the parasympathetic is excitatory, but to different components of the pupil. All right, so sympathetic is going to cause the radial fibers of the eye to contract, and that's going to open up the pupil, make your pupil get very big, all right? But parasympathetic activity is going to cause the radial fibers or circular fibers of the iris to contract, and that's going to cause constriction of the pupil. But nonetheless, dilation and constriction are what? Opposite effects on the eye. although it affects two different kinds of fibers. Okay, let's look at the heart, for instance. In terms of the heart, sympathetic activity increases, all right, the heart rate. Parasympathetic stimulation decreases heart rate. And the job of your autonomic nervous system is to balance that out so that you have precise control of your heart rate. What else? Here is something interesting. Notice that only sympathetic nerves go to the ventricle muscles themselves. Ah, here. Right? And so sympathetic stimulation on the heart increases the force of contraction, but there are no parasympathetic nerves that go to the heart to decrease it. So that's just sort of interesting anomaly there. And the same thing for blood vessels. Right? Innervation to blood vessels mostly causes constriction in most organs, but there are very, very few that have parasympathetic innervation. Okay? So I think that's kind of interesting for the following reason. In the cardiovascular system, there's a very prevalent disease process. And can you think of some disease processes involving a person's cardiovascular system? And one is actually really hard to treat. Okay, yeah, coronary artery disease is real important and prevalent. That's not the one I'm thinking of, though. But I'm not sure I can hear anybody. But the one I'm thinking of, okay, it's called hypertension. Who's heard of hypertension? And what is hypertension? High blood pressure. That's right. And it's very prevalent. And, of course, it's a very deadly disease. So it's really important to know about this particular pathology. And so high blood pressure happens when your blood pressure increases. So let's think of when that might happen. So think of a balloon, okay? And grab the balloon with two hands and squeeze down on the balloon. What happens to the pressure inside that balloon as you squeeze down on it? Does it go up or does it go down or does it stay the same when you squeeze down on it? Yeah, it goes way up, right? As a matter of fact, if you squeeze really hard on the balloon, the pressure might increase so much, right, that the balloon is going to pop, right? And of course, that could happen to us if our blood pressure goes too high, right? Our blood vessels could pop open. That would what we call an aneurysm or a dissecting aneurysm, okay? So blood pressure or hypertension is a very prevalent disease kind of process. And by looking at the neuroanatomy right here, that probably describes why it's so prevalent, because in order to have nice, precise control over your body, like, for instance, heart rate, what do you have? Both sympathetic and parasympathetic innervation, meaning that you have precise control of your heart rate. But what about to your blood vessels? Mostly it causes constriction, okay? And is there a parasympathetic component to that? Very few organs have parasympathetic innervation. So any kind of neuronal activity to blood vessels is going to do what? Cause constriction, and when blood vessels constrict, what happens to your blood pressure? It goes up, okay? So, for instance, if our body was designed in this nice, purely antagonistic way, if we had both parasympathetic and sympathetic nerves going to blood vessels, then our brain could do what? Could vasoconstrict, increase in our blood pressure. It could then actively vasodilate to decrease blood pressure. And if that were designed that way, I would guess hypertension wouldn't be nearly as prevalent a disease process, right? But most things in your body cause what? Constriction, meaning your blood pressure increases. All right, including when you go see that movie, what nervous system gets activated? Sympathetic nervous system gets activated. Guess what happens to your blood pressure? It goes up. You don't have a nervous system to bring it back down, okay, at a moment's notice. All right, so that's one interesting thing that I see when I look at the autonomic nervous system. All right, and as a matter of fact, when you start to think about, oh, I got a test next week, what nervous system is being activated? Sympathetic nervous system. What happens to your blood pressure? It goes up. Or maybe you thought, oh, I left my keys at home. What happens to your blood pressure? All right, it goes up, right? And you don't have a nervous system to bring it back down. Okay. In the lungs, bronchioles, all right, so these are tubes that distribute air to the lungs. Sympathetic activity causes dilation. Parasympathetic causes constriction. Dilation means relaxation. All right, so the other thing that we see right here is that sometimes the sympathetic nervous system is stimulatory, right? Like in terms of heart rate, it increases heart rate. But in terms of the bronchioles, it is inhibitory. It causes them to relax. So you can't always just say that the sympathetic nervous system is stimulatory. You have to know organ by organ. But the only other thing is what the one thing that you do know, if the sympathetic is inhibitory, what about the parasympathetic nervous system? It is going to be the opposite. It's going to be excitatory. All right, so that's one thing that you should always know. In terms of motility of the gastrointestinal tract, right? The sympathetic nervous system inhibits movement, right? Decreases peristalsis. So then what do you automatically know about the parasympathetic nervous system? It increases peristalsis, right? It is excitatory. All right. So those are the things that I wanted you to appreciate from this table right here. Okay. All right, so let's look at autonomic nervous system neurotransmitters. All right, so here is another nice diagram that shows the central nervous system and then autonomic outflow. So what is thoracolumbar outflow again? That is
sympathetic,
and cranial sacral is parasympathetic. And here you can see the solid lines are myelinated fibers, the dotted lines are non-myelinated fibers. And which division of the autonomic nervous system has relatively short preganglionic fibers? It's the sympathetic, right? Because the parasympathetic has these relatively long preganglionic fibers and microscopically short postganglionic fibers. Yeah, you should be able to see that. All right, so how is information moved from the preganglionic fiber to the postganglionic fiber? Is this an electrical synapse or a chemical synapse in these ganglion? It's a chemical synapse, right? And so what has to be used? A neurotransmitter. All right, and here we see the neurotransmitter that is used, right, at each of these ganglia, right, whether it is a parasympathetic ganglion or a sympathetic ganglia, what is the neurotransmitter that's used in every case? Acetylcholine. So all preganglionic fibers are what we call cholinergic, right? Because cholinergic means using acetylcholine. And the receptor in all of these ganglia right here is a nicotinic receptor. So in every case, these receptors are stimulated, right, by acetylcholine. Means it's going to produce EPSPs in the postganglionic fiber. All right? And so this might, you might wonder, or maybe you have wondered, why is it that when somebody takes nicotine into their body, for maybe they smoke a cigarette or chew tobacco or for whatever reason, if nicotine acts like acetylcholine and it stimulates the whole autonomic nervous system, how come it's not fatal? Right? If all of a sudden you take all this acetylcholine into your body or something that acts like it, like nicotine, how come it doesn't completely mess up your autonomic nervous system, and how is it that you just don't die automatically right away? It always just amazes me that that doesn't happen. But you'll see why when you can understand some neuroanatomy, and that is, right, nicotine does what? It stimulates the postganglionic fiber of the parasympathetic nervous system as well as the sympathetic nervous system. All right, so if we stimulate the parasympathetic nervous system to the same degree as the sympathetic nervous system, what's the overall effect going to be? They cancel out. That's really the beautiful thing about antagonistic nervous systems. If for some reason there's an errant signal or some kind of noise in the system, the end result is that that is going to cancel out. So that's the reason why people can smoke cigarettes and not just automatically die from overstimulation of the autonomic nervous system. And that's because why? The parasympathetic and sympathetic have opposite effects in the body and they cancel out in most cases. Okay. All right, now what about the postganglionic neuron? The neurotransmitter that's used here now is different. the neurotransmitter that's used is norepinephrine for the sympathetic nervous system, but the neurotransmitter that's used for the parasympathetic is acetylcholine, right? Okay, and so parasympathetic postganglionic fibers are cholinergic. The postganglionic fibers for the sympathetic nervous system are not cholinergic, they're what we call adrenergic because they use norepinephrine as the neurotransmitter. All right, so you got to make sure you can understand cholinergic as opposed to adrenergic. And then the only caveat that we have to say is that that adrenal medulla, okay, we don't really call those, you know, that's sort of like an adrenergic system, but it doesn't release neurotransmitter. It releases what? Neurohormones directly into the circulation, and they're distributed that way. So this is a pretty good figure to understand, and it might even be an exam figure. Okay, I can't remember if it is. It might be an exam figure. Okay, the synapses of the autonomic nervous system, or the architecture of the synapses, is a little bit different in the autonomic nervous system compared to somatic nervous system, in that, or in synapses even in the brain, in that neurotransmitter from, say, a somatic neuron is only released at the axon terminus, but here we can see an autonomic neuron, and there are varicosities or bulges along the whole length of the axon, not just the axon terminus, and inside these bulges, which we call varicosities, there are synaptic vesicles containing neurotransmitters. So when a nerve impulse moves down this axon right here, this whole axon is going to be releasing neurotransmitter along its whole length. So this is a different kind of arrangement. Sometimes we call this synapses en passant or in passing. So here we might have an example of a smooth muscle, and it's going to receive dual innervation from a parasympathetic fiber as well as a sympathetic fiber, and we have these varicosities releasing neurotransmitter along their whole length, so we don't even have even a neuromuscular junction on smooth muscle. All right, the other thing about skeletal muscle, I think I mentioned, is that when an action potential reaches the axon terminus, what does a smooth muscle do? Does it sit there and ponder its possibilities of whether it's going to contract or not? No, it's going to contract 100% of the time when a nerve impulse reaches the axon terminus, right? So that's because the neuromuscular junction is so big, it always produces a threshold stimulus in the skeletal muscle. The skeletal muscle has to contract. It can't ever do anything else. But in smooth muscle, what do we have? We have numerous graded potentials, and these, right, will summate, right? So smooth muscle can actually integrate information up from both the parasympathetic and sympathetic nervous system, and same thing for cardiac muscle. And so it can make a decision on what to do based on what is predominating, whether it's sympathetic activity or parasympathetic activity. So its activity can be graded as well. Skeletal muscle is an all or none response. It can't make up its mind how to adjust its activity. But a smooth muscle cell can. Okay, so let's just focus on adrenergic stimulation first, which is what? Adrenergic is going to be sympathetic or parasympathetic because of the postganglionic fiber. It's going to be sympathetic, right? Sympathetic stimulation. Adrenergic stimulation can cause either excitation or inhibition depending on the tissue. All right, so one neurotransmitter, what's a neurotransmitter for adrenergic stimulation? Norepinephrine. So how is it that norepinephrine, one signaling molecule, can either have excitation or inhibition depending on the tissue, meaning norepinephrine can produce EPSPs or IPSPs, depending on the tissue? Why is it that one signaling molecule can have different effects in your body? And I'm not sure I mentioned that in this class yet. Okay. Okay. It has only to do with norepinephrine, and that is because a tissue can have different kinds of receptors. Right, and different receptors mean maybe different channels can open up. So one signaling molecule can have different effects in your body because there are different receptors. All right, so for instance, if there is a receptor that opens up a sodium channel, what's that going to produce? An EPSP. But if it opens up a chloride channel, that's going to produce an IPSP. Right, so one signaling molecule can have opposite effects in your body depending on what kind of receptor is placed into the cell membrane by the nucleus of that particular cell. All right, so adrenergic receptors have different subtypes, right? But it's all they're going to be stimulated by the same neurotransmitter. The two major subtypes we call alpha and beta receptors. And these are what? Adrenergic receptors, that's what we're talking about. Furthermore, there can be some subtypes of these receptors. Alpha 1, alpha 2, that's a subtype of an alpha, and beta 1 and beta 2 kinds of receptors that are going to produce different effects in the body. But there is a common theme for all of these adrenergic receptors, no matter what type or subtype they are. They're all G protein coupled receptors working through a second messenger system. All right, so do you have a picture of what a G protein coupled receptor looks like? All right, you got a receptor which is not a channel. You got G proteins that once the ligand binds to the receptor dissociate, and that can control the opening or closing of different channels that are placed in the cell membrane. All right, so furthermore, the beta receptors use cyclic AMP as a second messenger. I think that's an exam figure for the next test. You should be able to label a G protein coupled receptor mechanism that uses cyclic AMP. And the alphas use calcium as a second messenger. All right, so when we look at these adrenergic receptors that use cyclic AMP or calcium as a second messenger, what's going to be the first messenger in every case? Let's see if anybody... Okay. Where is the first messenger located always?
Outside
the cell. The second messenger is inside the cell. So what is the first messenger for adrenergic receptors, whether they're alpha or beta receptors? What's going to stimulate that receptor? It's going to be a neurotransmitter, but in particular, which neurotransmitter? Norepinephrine, because, yeah, we're talking about an adrenergic system right here. Right? So norepinephrine is the primary agonist or the primary stimulating molecule for this kind of receptor. Now, some of these might also respond to, what's a molecule that's similar to norepinephrine? Similar to norepinephrine is epinephrine from the adrenal medulla. And epinephrine might also stimulate these different adrenergic receptors in your body. Okay. All right, so let's look at some selected adrenergic effects on different organs. So, for instance, in the eye, contraction of the radial fibers, all right, the fiber, when we get into senses, you'll be able to see how this happens. Sorry about the pun. But anyway, the radial fibers are like spokes on a bicycle, and when they contract, that pulls your iris open. That causes what? Pupil dilation. Your pupil gets bigger. Your pupil is just a hole in your iris. All right, and that is controlled by alpha-1 adrenergic receptors. All right, so what is this alpha-1? Does that cause relaxation or contraction? Is it excitatory or inhibitory? It is excitatory, right? So alpha-1s try to think of as being excitatory. So they're going to work through what? Some kind of sodium channel, causing these radial fibers to contract that are going to pull your iris open. Okay, so alpha-1s are excitatory. Heart rate, increased heart rate, and force of contraction, that's a beta receptor, and primarily beta 1. So again, beta 1 you should think of as being excitatory. It's going to open up sodium channels, for instance, in your heart. Okay. Skin and visceral blood vessels, arterioles constrict due to smooth muscle contraction. What kind of adrenergic receptor did we already look at that causes stimulation? That is the alpha 1. Right, so alpha-1 receptors cause vasoconstriction. That's primarily also responsible for increasing your blood pressure. Okay, when your blood vessels constrict. Let's see, skeletal muscles. Here are some in muscles. All right, there's this first line right here is not so important. You might even want to cross that out. What I want you to know about are these beta 2 receptors in skeletal muscle. They respond to epinephrine. Where does epinephrine come from? The adrenal gland, okay? And what did we call the sympathetic system again? The parasympathetic was rest and repose, but the sympathetic was the fight or flight response. So if you're going to fly away or if you're going to fight, what do your blood vessels, what do your skeletal muscles need? What do blood vessels need if you're going to exercise them strenuously? They need oxygen. Where do you get oxygen from? From blood, right? Okay. So blood vessels going to skeletal muscle, and under those circumstances, need to be perfused. They need a lot of blood. And the way that skeletal muscles get perfusion is by dilating a blood vessel. All right. So in this particular case, in the fight or flight response, arterioles dilate due to epinephrine bringing blood to skeletal muscle because skeletal muscles need nutrients in order to be active. All right. So they don't have alpha 1 or beta 1, which cause smooth muscle to contract. They have beta 2 that causes smooth muscle to relax, bringing blood to skeletal muscle. All right. Same thing for in a fight or flight response, bronchioles, airways. They dilate. So what happens to smooth muscle of your airways? Does it constrict, okay, and block off airflow to your lungs, or do they dilate? Do they relax so that you can bring more air into your lungs? They've got to relax and dilate to bringing more air into your lungs so that skeletal muscle can get that oxygen. So that's a beta 2 receptor. All right. So these are what? Inhibitory. They're going to open up, for instance, like a chloride channel or a potassium channel. They're going to hyperpolarize these membranes, thereby causing relaxation of these smooth muscles. I think that's an alpha 1 right there. Yeah, sympathetic contraction of sphincters that slows the passage of food through the digestive tract. And in the liver, glycogenolysis and secretion of glucose, right, is stimulated by alpha 1 and beta 2 receptors. All right, so the sympathetic nervous system does control or can't control respiration as a result of that. Yes, these would be excitatory because they stimulate the secretion of glucose. Yeah. Yeah, you know, I don't have an alpha 2 up here unless I can't see it through the smudge right here. The alpha 2s have even a little bit more complicated effects. Alpha 2s we find in the central nervous system, and sometimes they are stimulatory and sometimes they're inhibitory. So I don't even talk about alpha 2s in this class. But so we don't find those usually in the periphery, but they're in the central nervous system. And drugs that work on alpha 2 receptors are used clinically, but we kind of know how to use them just empirically, just because of what happens to people after they take them. But the mechanism, at least I don't understand the mechanism by which they work. So I don't cover it in this class. But that might be something you have to learn in 5 years. And it would be really great because a lot of people use alpha 2 blockers. Okay?
So those could be either inhibitory or
inhibitory. So which one?
The beta 2.
The beta 2, yeah, let's look right here. All right, they cause dilation. So these are inhibitory. Beta 2s are always inhibitory. Beta 1, on the other hand, is excitatory. Alpha 1 is excitatory. It's going to cause contraction of smooth muscle.
So in the last case, you have alpha 1 and beta
2. Yeah. So these maybe would be antagonistic to each other in the pancreas. Okay. So there's one last figure that's going to help you memorize this table right here. So the table is not going to be on the test. And that is this figure right here. So this kind of summarizes everything that we have in this chapter. Now, what kind of nervous system are we looking at on this slide? Is this an autonomic or a somatic nervous system? And how would you know? I heard some people say autonomic. Now, since you've made a decision on autonomic, why, what prompted you to say autonomic nervous system and not somatic? Yeah, because we see two neurons back to back. And we see, what, a ganglion in between them. If it was just one nerve fiber, then that would be a somatic pathway, right? But since we see two nerve fibers, that's got to be autonomic. All right, so here we have one column for parasympathetic, and we have three over here for sympathetic. The parasympathetic preganglionic fiber, is that adrenergic or cholinergic?
Cholinergic.
Okay, cholinergic because why? It is releasing acetylcholine, okay, at the ganglion right here. All right, and the postganglionic fiber, is that adrenergic or cholinergic? That's cholinergic, again, because of acetylcholine. All right, and the receptors, remember, all of these receptors right here are nicotinic acetylcholine receptors. So even for the sympathetic nervous system, the preganglionic fibers are what, cholinergic or adrenergic? They're cholinergic because they release acetylcholine as well. And these are always nicotinic receptors in these dendrites and cell bodies right here. So what could you tell me about a nicotinic receptor again? A nicotinic receptor, it's got to bind two acetylcholine molecules. And when it binds two acetylcholine molecules, what happens? A channel opens up. So it's a receptor channel. It opens up and sodium can enter the cell. That always produces EPSPs. All right, so acetylcholine is always going to be excitatory on this postganglionic fiber, as well as this one, as well as this postganglionic fiber, and then this last postganglionic fiber, acetyl, always going to be excitatory because it's a nicotinic receptor. Yeah.
So what happens to acetylcholine, the sympathetic?
Yeah.
The neuron receives acetylcholine, but then it secretes norepinephrine.
Yes, it can.
So what happens?
What happens? Well, don't forget, on this postsynaptic membrane right here, there's something that breaks acetylcholine down, and that is acetylcholinesterase. So acetylcholine is just used to produce EPSPs on this neuron. And when those EPSPs reach the axon hillock, that's going to trigger an action potential. It's going to flow down this axon, and when the action potential reaches the axon terminus, that's going to release the neurotransmitter from these synaptic vesicles down over here. But the neurotransmitter in these synaptic vesicles is not acetylcholine. It is norepinephrine in the sympathetic system, but it is acetylcholine in the parasympathetic nervous system. All right, so that's why we say the acetylcholine is the predominant neurotransmitter in the parasympathetic, but norepinephrine is the primary neurotransmitter in the sympathetic nervous system. The only other difference that you should see is that at the ganglion, it's always what? Acetylcholine. Okay. Okay, so in this particular case, in most effector organs of the autonomic nervous system, the receptor type for acetylcholine is not a nicotinic receptor, it's a muscarinic receptor. And that produces the parasympathetic effects. And muscarinic receptors don't always have to be excitatory. They can be inhibitory. And I think that is an exam figure. You do have a muscarinic receptor. How could you maybe tell me the difference between a nicotinic receptor and muscarinic? A muscarinic is not just simply a receptor channel. It's what? It's a G protein-coupled receptor. All right, so it's a lot different. The G proteins are activated. They have to bump into a channel, and that will open up a channel. And if it's a potassium channel, that's going to hyperpolarize that cell or inhibit that cell. Okay, so for instance, on the heart, what's the effect of parasympathetic stimulation on the heart? Okay, It decreases heart rate because it hyperpolarizes the myocardium, especially the nodal cells of the heart, like the SA node, because it opens up a potassium channel. Now, if the heart had nicotinic receptors, what would happen with parasympathetic stimulation? it would speed the heart up. But that's not how the system has evolved, thank goodness. Okay? So muscarinic receptors are going to slow the heart down because they hyperpolarize the nodal fibers. Okay. All right, so let's turn our attention to the sympathetic fibers. So this first column right here, again, the preganglionic fiber releases acetylcholine. They bind to nicotinic receptors on the postganglionic cell. That sends an action potential down to the axon terminus. It releases norepinephrine. All right, and in this particular case, we're going to stimulate some alpha-1 receptors. Typically, how would you think of alpha-1? Inhibitory or excitatory? Yeah, excitatory. So it's going to cause vasoconstriction. All right, so when you say vaso, that means blood vessels in the viscera and the skin. Because, for instance, when you're in the fight or flight response, you need to have blood flow going to organs, digesting material, or do you need to have blood flow going to skeletal muscle so that they can operate? Skeletal muscle, right? Okay, so alpha-1 receptors cause vasoconstriction in all of these organs that you don't necessarily have to have active when you're facing a life-threatening circumstance. Okay, second column right here. Norepinephrine stimulates beta-1 receptors. Where do you find beta-1 receptors? On the heart. All right, and so when you're in a fight or flight response, what should happen to your heart rate? Increase or decrease? It should increase. So the beta-1 receptors increase heart rate as well as contractility. That's going to increase blood flow everywhere in your body, including to skeletal muscles, which is what you need during a fight or flight response. All right, last column right here. The beta-2 receptors. Where do we find the beta-2 receptors? In bronchioles, and norepinephrine is going to inhibit that smooth muscle right here. It's going to relax, and when that smooth muscle relaxes, what happens to the diameter of these airways? It increases, and you can have more airflow, bringing more oxygen into your body during a fight-or-flight response. All right, so I think you can get a feel for the importance of these different receptors in different parts of your body to produce a proper fight or flight response. All right, so this is a really key diagram. Make sure you can label this diagram because this will help you remember, you know, the different subtypes of receptors and what the effects are in the body. So beta-1, where do you have beta-1 receptors? In the heart. In the heart. How many hands do I need to point to my heart? One. What kind of receptor is that? Beta 1. Okay, where do you have beta 2 receptors? Your lungs. How many hands do you need to point to your lungs? What kind of receptor is there? Beta 2. Okay, but you got to remember, and I think it'd be easy to remember that sympathetic stimulation on the heart is stimulatory, sympathetic stimulation on the lungs is inhibitory, causes bronchial dilation. Okay? Okay, yeah. Yes, they're always sodium channels, predominantly sodium, yeah. Okay, they don't work through a nicotinic, is never a G-protein coupled type receptor. So remember when we talked about that G-protein coupled receptor, how confusing it was? We said sometimes it can produce depolarization, sometimes it can produce hyperpolarization depending on the channel. All right, so here is an example. These are all G-protein coupled receptors. In this particular case, it is opening a sodium channel, right, is producing EPSPs, but in this case right here, it's producing IPSPs causing inhibition. Both are G-protein coupled receptors. So it depends on the part of the body that we're talking about. Okay. Right, so that was pretty much just adrenergic stimulation. We do have to look at cholinergic stimulation as well. Acetylcholine is used at all motor neuron synapses, all right, which is what? The neuromuscular junction. Those are nicotinic receptors. Remember, skeletal muscle just always contracts when acetylcholine is placed on it. All preganglionic junctions in the autonomic nervous system, right? That's the synapse between the preganglionic and postganglionic fiber. Oh, the sinus sheet. I had one, but I wonder if I brought it down. Rats. Yeah, I didn't have it. Who wants to pass a sheet around real quick?
like,
yeah, just rip out a blank sheet. That, I guess that would be you. Okay, put the date on it in the class. All right, so you know that there are how many different major subtypes of cholinergic receptors? Two. And they're the nicotinic and muscarinic type. All right. Nicotinic types are also stimulated by nicotine, blocked by curare. I think I talked about that already. The muscarinic type is stimulated exogenously with a chemical called muscarin that comes from poisonous mushrooms. And the muscarinic type receptors are not found in the sympathetic nervous system, so that when somebody takes into their body muscarin, that is fatal because it doesn't affect the sympathetic nervous system. There's no counterbalance right there. Unlike nicotine, right, stimulates antagonistic effects in the autonomic nervous system. And muscarin, a nice antidote would be, for instance, atropine blocks the receptor for muscarin. So here are, who's seen this before? Anybody seen this figure before? Probably this is, you're dreading the time when you would actually see this in class, but now maybe it sort of makes a little bit of sense, okay? So here is a nicotinic kind of receptor. It is just a channel receptor. It opens up when it binds two acetylcholines. The primary effect is what? Sodium entering the cell that causes depolarization or excitation. The muscarinic type receptor, right, produces parasympathetic effects in the heart, smooth muscle, and glands, and it is always a G protein coupled receptor. It's not just an ion channel that opens up. So here is the receptor, here's the G protein, and when it's activated, in this particular case, if it's going to cause inhibition, it's going to produce an IPSP or hyperpolarization by opening a potassium channel. But a if you remove the receptor, these channels are still here, but they won't ever change state. They won't ever open up or close. They'll just stay closed all the time.
Would that affect
the physiology? Oh, absolutely. Yeah, so that's going to change. That's going to affect the membrane potential, and that's going to block the transfer of information. Yeah, so you have to have the receptor here. In order for a cell to respond to a signaling molecule, what does it have to have? It's got to have a receptor. So this cell is going to be blind to acetylcholine if it doesn't have the receptor right here. So it won't be able to change its physiology when it's being told to. Yeah, so it needs to have that receptor. All right, but a muscarinic receptor can also be excitatory. So it has the same kind of receptor and G protein. But in this particular case, it might cause depolarization one of two ways, maybe opening a sodium or calcium channel, and of course they're both going to enter the cell causing depolarization. All right, but here's another case to think about. Here we have a potassium channel, and let's just say that it is normally open. And when this potassium channel is normally open, what is it producing? Hyperpolarization, right? It is hyperpolarizing the membrane because potassium is leaking out. Now, let's close that channel. And then what are we going to do? We're going to take away that hyperpolarization. And what is the opposite of hyperpolarization? That is depolarization. So if this potassium channel is closed, that is also going to depolarize the membrane, causing excitation. Right, and so that's how muscarinic receptors work in smooth muscle of the digestive tract, one of these two different channels right here. Okay. So here we see even some subtypes of the muscarinic receptors. And you know what? I think I'm going to stop here. We're going to talk about this slide after the test because you don't need to know this for the test. But you can look it over before the next lecture, right? We'll talk about some subtypes of muscarinic. Some are stimulatory, some are inhibitory. Yeah. Yeah, your test is going to be all Scantron. So somewhere between 50 and 100 questions. What was it last time? 80, 90, I don't know, something like that. You know, those colors just kind of evade me. I'm just not really familiar with colors. It's 882E. 882E, not the Lovas one, not the 8AT Lovas or ES, just the 882E is the best. Yeah, 882E. That's right. Not this one. Not this one. Same. Yeah. Yeah. Okay, so make sure you got those exam figures down. That's key.